Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the mid-1990s, today's guest, award-winning filmmaker Rodney Evans, was diagnosed with a rare genetic disorder, which causes a gradual loss of vision. But that did not stop him from going on to direct 7 documentaries and 2 feature films. In his new documentary, Vision Portraits, Rodney Evans tells his story and chronicles the creative paths of 3 other blind and visually impaired artists, including a photographer, a dancer, and a writer. The film uses techniques like blurred images to portray the gradual loss of vision that the artists have experienced. As the modern world quickly moves around them, they navigate challenges in their artistic processes and in the outside world. For visually impaired artists, how does lack of eyesight enhance their creative process? Rodney Evans is the writer, director, and producer of the 2004 feature film Brother to Brother, which won the Special Jury Prize in Drama at the Sundance Film Festival. His second narrative feature, The Happy Sad, has played at over 30 film festivals throughout the world. And his latest documentary is called Vision Portraits. It premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival this year in the documentary feature competition. And it's going to be opening across the country in the coming days. If you are in the Bay Area, it is screening now at Landmark's Opera Plaza Cinema in San Francisco. And Rodney will be taking part in 3 Q&As over the next couple days. And I will announce those throughout the show. Rodney Evans joins us in studio. Hi, Rodney. Thank you for coming in.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, this is such a beautiful film, and I think there's so much that stood out for me, but one of the sentences in the film from you that really got me was, I'm trying to figure out what it means to work as a filmmaker where vision seems to be central, knowing that mine might eventually go away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was, I think, you know, the pivotal question that I was asking myself was, what am I going to do if my vision continues to deteriorate? How am I going to function as a filmmaker? And, you know, I think that that confrontation with that fear is what led me to want to engage with these other artists that, were either fully blind or had severe visual impairment, and, you know, how they went about creating their art, frankly, in that condition, what kind of obstacles they faced, how did they accommodate due to lack of vision, what kind of resources did they have to call on, what kind of assistance did they work with. It came from a deeply personal place, but then I wanted my personal story to kind of be the launching point into this engagement with these other artists and understanding their creative process and what I could learn from it.
Initially, you weren't planning to be in the film.
No, I wasn't. Yeah, that was something that gradually happened over the course of editing. As I think happens with a lot of documentaries, which is sort of the beauty of documentary, is that they change as you're shooting, and they evolve as they're being edited and as you're thinking about what the right structure for the film might be. And so I think at first I thought I might just be a framing device where I talk about my condition and talk about why I want to engage with these specific types of artists, and then maybe come back at the end and talk about some of the things that I gleaned from these dialogues. But then it became more and more clear that people were really craving what I was getting from them, in the course of watching the film. And so it just became more clear that these interstitial moments needed to be there, and that my character basically was the main character that was changing over the course of the film. And, I was the journey that the that the viewer was following over the course of the film. And so it very much became a piece about me in conversation with these different artists, as opposed to a film that was just episodic and had these different chapters. So I think my story is the thread or the through line that connects all of these different components.
It was interesting to also hear you talk about what it's like to work in the film industry, which can be a very judgmental, as you said, racist, homophobic industry.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that you were afraid of the stigma that might affect future career possibilities.
Yep.
You weren't sure whether or not you felt comfortable in public with a cane because someone in the industry might see you.
Yeah. Yes, for sure. I mean, I think that was a huge dilemma for me for many years. And I think that in many ways, it was a burden in that, within the film industry, it's a lot about presentation. Sometimes it's not even about your track record or your body of work, or sometimes you're just judged based on your ability to present a project and whether you are moving people in the room with your presentation, right? And a lot of that is just, it's about performance, and it's about, constructing a certain identity, for lack of a better term. And so for me, I always felt a bit uncomfortable about that. I wanted to be judged by the films that I had made and the work that I had done and the scripts that I had written. And I'm not an actor. I'm not a performer. So I'm not going to come in and have tears streaming down your face by the story that I'm telling. I can present it clearly, but so I feel like, there are these stigmas and these stereotypes about what visual impairment means. And I think people, not just in the film industry, but in general, but I think especially in the film industry, because it is a visual medium, people tend to underestimate what visually impaired filmmakers can do, mm-hmm. right? And so for me, as someone who has no peripheral vision and has tunnel vision, I can think of the ways in which my condition actually helps me as a filmmaker, in that it helps me block out all of the lighting and all of the technical apparatus that's happening around me, which is not really my job, right? I've hired a gaffer and a cinematographer, and they're people that I trust who are going to bring their A game. And my responsibility as a director is to be focusing on either, the actors in the case of fiction film, or the characters or the people that I'm interviewing if it's a documentary, and what are the questions that I'm asking them? What is the sense of intimacy and trust that I'm creating for them to feel most comfortable in conveying a vulnerable side of themselves that the audience then that can connect to? So, I mean, that's what I feel like my job is, and is not the job of anyone else on set. So that's where I try to put my focus. And so just to have a condition where you are literally just looking at that person and and all of the lighting equipment and the boom poles and everything that's around them is not in your field of vision, can be extremely helpful, because you're really concentrating on what's going on in their faces and what's happening with them emotionally.
Do you feel like over the years things have gotten a little better in filmmaking for people with disabilities, given all of the attention on like the Oscars So White campaign, Me Too? There's just all of these campaigns to try to diversify who's in films and who actually makes films.
Yeah.
How has that affected people with disabilities?
When I talk about it, I think of it as just kind of like baby steps. I think we're at this really early stage of representation in terms of disabled characters. I mean, I think the statistics are 1 in 4 Americans identify as having a disability, mm-hmm. yet 0.2% of characters in film and media are seen as having a disability. So that's a huge void.
Just 0.2%.
0.2%. So, so I think that has a lot to do with fear and shame, both on the part of, you know, executives that have the power to greenlight and put projects forward. I think it's an underestimation of what people want to see and what people can relate to. I think it's bad business, frankly, because it's actually not showing an aspect of life that so many people are going through that they can empathize with and connect to, and stories that that need to be told, right? And disabled people, both in front of and behind the camera, can be employed to tell those stories. So, you know, I think that, you know, there, I could count the amount of shows probably on two hands, you know. That, I mean, one that comes to mind is Ryan O'Connell's show special on Netflix, which deals with him having cerebral palsy and passing, and then having to come out with cerebral palsy, and what does that mean for him as a gay man, and, you know, his sexuality and showing him with sexual desire. And so I think it's about not, you know, just having those characters, but having them be multidimensional and nuanced, and not just having the disability be the identifying factor of their character, but showing all of the multiplicity of who they are and having that be one element of who they are, but, you know, a central pivotal element. But, yeah, I think that there's a long, long way to go. And so, I'm hoping that Vision Portraits can contribute to that canon of representation and just move the needle and let people know that these stories are out there, that they're relatable, that, you know, if it's one in four people, it's, you know, the likelihood that you're going to one day fall into, because it's gradual, right? We fall more into the disability community as we age. You know, there are things that we are no longer capable of doing that we have to rely on other people to do. And so, so I just, when I hear statistics like that, I try not to harp so much on the negative, but I try to be proactive, and I try to make work that fills the void, and that that frankly I want to see as a viewer.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so I'm always advocating for filmmakers to do that.
And hearing you talk about this Netflix show, it makes me think, and I was thinking about this when I was watching your film, that if someone who was not visually impaired made the same film, it would have been completely different.
Yeah.
And so it's so important to have people with disabilities behind the scenes telling these stories.
Oh, yeah.
Is there like an organization, or do you have – are there people networking to try to raise awareness about this?
About people behind the camera,
yeah,
telling those stories, not that I'm aware of, mm-hmm. and I've also been advocating for the formation of those kinds of organizations. I mean, even within the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, there is something called the Minority Consortia, which, you know, there's Black Public Media for African American filmmakers. There's CAM, which is the Center for Asian American Media Makers. So there are all of these organizations for these different minority groups. And my thought process is, if one in four, Americans are within the disabled community, then that's the largest minority group in the country, right? And so why is there no minority consortium group for that community and advocating for them to tell those stories both in front of and behind the camera? And I think it's a question for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to be asking themselves. How can they allocate, you know, parts of their budget to an organization like that? How can an organization like that be created and run? And frankly, I had, you know, characters in my film tell me that if I wasn't making this film, they would not be a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
that there was no way they would ever trust a fully sighted, non-visually impaired filmmaker with their story, with getting the story right, with getting the nuances, with getting all of the dimensions. I think that there is an intimacy and a trust that comes from a shared experience and not having to explain what your experience is to a filmmaker, but they just know in their DNA, and you already start from a place of shared experience and intimacy because you have that commonality. And so, yeah, frankly, Kayla, one of the characters, the dancer in the film, I was doing a Q&A with her, and she just straight up said, yeah, if Rodney wasn't making this film, I wouldn't have participated.
Wow. We'll talk about Kayla in just a minute. Today we're speaking with award-winning filmmaker Rodney Evans about his new documentary, Vision Portraits. This film follows the journeys of four blind and visually impaired artists, including Rodney, and it'll be opening, if you're in the Bay Area, tomorrow at Landmark's Opera Plaza Cinema in San Francisco. And Rodney will be taking part in three Q&As tomorrow night at 7:10, Saturday at 2:30, and Saturday at 7:10. Yes,
yes.
Right. So there's two on Saturday, 2:30, yeah, and 7:10. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And I should say that the Saturday 7:10 screening will be open audio description for the blind and low vision communities and anyone else who might want to understand the impact of an audio description track on a viewing experience. Can you tell us what that's like?
Yeah, I can. So an audio description track, for people that don't know, is basically a track that that translates visuals into language. And so it's, you know, specifically designed for low vision and blind viewers to have a more optimal viewing experience. So if there's a montage of me in Berlin and I'm waiting for a train and I'm climbing up stairs of a hospital and I'm going into a movie theater and just all of this information that's going to come through visually and it's just music there, that is translated into language. So there's someone describing each shot as it's happening. And so it's usually happening, the description is happening in between interview sound bites or dialogue. So it's not conflicting ever with other dialogue on the screen. It's just happening when it's more visual moments that that are there to provide additional information that people might not be able to get from just the purely visual. And so I spent a lot of time, frankly, working on that track with a really great writer / vocalist named Erin DeWard, who has done fantastic work. She did a documentary called Wild, Wild Country that was on Netflix. And I also talked to a disability studies scholar named Georgina Klieg, who writes about blindness and art and is blind. And I went to a talk that she gave at NYU, and she talked about how awful audio descriptions usually are because they're very robotic and people are encouraged to be kind of monotonal and not show emotion, which she thought was, you know, terrible advice. And so one of my main questions to her during the Q&A was, so what advice do you have for a filmmaker who's going into their post sound process to make a really good audio description track? And she basically said, stay involved, hire the person that is writing it, be there when they're recording the track, you know, give them direction in the same way that you would give your actor direction. So I followed all of that advice, where I think the norm is to treat audio description the way that that people treat captioning, which is the distributor usually takes it and they farm it out to a company, and then it just comes back completed. and you have no say in what it is. It is what it is, whether you like it or not. That's the track that's being put onto your movie. And so if you talk to blind and low vision viewers, they hate them. And so, but we've gotten a lot of positive feedback about this audio description track. And so I'm really excited to be having it be an open audio description screening, really targeting the blind and low vision community. Because usually you have to wear headsets in order to access the audio description track. And it plays while you're watching the movie. But this has the audio description track embedded in the mix of the film. So it's for everyone to just hear. And if you've never experienced what an audio description track is and how that affects the film and the use of language to describe visuals, I think it can just be a unique experience to have. Especially for this film.
And that will be this Saturday at the 7:10 screening at Landmark's Opera Plaza Cinema in San Francisco. And you can find more information about other openings across the country at yourcallradio.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have a question or comment for Rodney, if you or someone you know is visually impaired and you have a story to share about what it's like to navigate today's world, what changes would you like to see? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And let's hear from Jennifer, who's calling from Lighthouse for the Blind in San Francisco. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. Hi, Rose. I wanted to let you and everyone listening know about Superfest Disability Film Festival. It's a place where people can see films by and about people who have disabilities. And most of the films are shown with open audio description. It's on October 12th and 13th here in San Francisco on the Sunday the 13th, and in Berkeley at the Freight and Salvage on the 12th. And it is put on by Longmore Institute and the Lighthouse for the Blind. And it's all at superfestfilm.com.
Great. Thank you so much, Jennifer. And hopefully if we have some open days around that time, we can do a show about that. So we'll be in touch. Thank you so much for calling.
All right. Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Rodney, before we go to break, I just wanted to talk about how this happened. Your career as a filmmaker started out on a pretty targeted path. You went to college to study media, and then you got your master's in film production at the California Institute for the Arts, and then you found out you were losing your vision. Can you talk about what happened at that time?
Yeah. I had moved back from California. I went to CalArts to study film and video. I spent 3 years working on a feature-length documentary there for my thesis. And there were just some strange visual occurrences that started to accrue that just let me know something odd was going on with my vision. Like, an example would be someone would extend their hand to shake my hand, and I just wouldn't see it. And they would look at me, and they'd say, "Aren't you going to shake my hand?" And I would be so shocked that I didn't see it, and so embarrassed and appalled, frankly. And I'd say, "Oh my God, of course," and apologize and shake their hand. But that had happened, a couple of times. Also in the subway in New York, a lot of times during rush hour, I would not see people cross my periphery, but they would suddenly appear 2 inches in front of me, and I would just be like totally shocked and have to kind of stop and take a breath because this body just suddenly appeared like right in front of me. So those are two examples of things where I was getting these signs that something was not okay with my vision. And so I went to an ophthalmologist and got tested, and they told me that I had this rare genetic condition called retinitis pigmentosa, and that the way that it was explained to me was that there were two dominant strains of the condition. One strain is that, you know, over the course of 6 to 8 years, you can basically lose most of your vision. And then the other strain is it progresses to a certain point, and then it plateaus for many, many decades. And then, you know, when you get older, i.e. into maybe your late 60s, early 70s, it can start to deteriorate more. But there are regimens and medications and things that you can do to help maintain the vision that you had. So they recommended that I go see a retinal specialist, who I've been seeing pretty much since then. And you know, for me, I think what I did was I tend to compartmentalize my film ideas. And for me, at that point, I was working on Brother to Brother, which was a very ambitious project that dealt with the Harlem Renaissance and specifically this younger gay generation during the Harlem Renaissance and also a contemporary black gay artist who had been thrown out of his house for being gay, and how those stories could intersect. And so for me, I just was like, okay, I have this condition. It seems like I have this version that's plateaued. I'm going to a retinal specialist. I'm doing everything that he's telling me to do to maintain my vision. I'm going to see him every 3 months in order for him to just do checkups and see if there are any major changes or adjustments that need to be made to this medication, if my eye pressure is okay, if there's any fluid building up in the back of my eyes, because there's something called edema, which is just basically fluid in the back of your eyes, which indicates that there's further deterioration happening. So you always want to try to keep that minimal as possible. And So for me, it's sort of like, I don't know, get on with it and use what you have to make the thing that you're really passionate and fiery about. And so that's what I did. I took 6 years to make Brother to Brother. So from 1998 to 2004, that was my main focus. And so once I put my energy and heart and passion into a project, I really just put my head down and put one step in front of the other until it's done. And so I really just worked like that for many years until, I would say, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, it felt like my vision was deteriorating more. I felt the need to, you know, use the red and white cane to navigate really crowded spaces. I was bumping into people in Penn Station. People were getting angry with me. Mm-hmm. So it just became more clear that that it was becoming a more dominant aspect of my life, right? And so I became afraid. You know, I became afraid of what I would do if my vision deteriorated more. And I think my MO as a filmmaker is to really move towards things that really scare me, and not to avoid them, but to go directly into them and to grapple with them through the work, and then to come out the other side having, you know, either understood them more clearly or conquered them, or, you know, move about the world with less fear and less shame, and hopefully learn something through the process. And so that definitely has been the case with Vision Portraits. So, so it's been a 5-year process of making this film.
And if you're in the Bay Area, Vision Portraits opens tomorrow at Landmark's Opera Plaza Cinema. You can find more information about where it opens in your area at yourcallradio.org. Today we're speaking with award-winning filmmaker Rodney Evans. We're going to take a quick break. This is Your Call.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation here on Your Call. You can call us on the telephone. You can send an email to yourcall@kalw.org. You may go to the yourcallradio.org website. If you're like to participate in today's show by phone, call us toll-free, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll discuss coverage of the G7 summit in France and the political crisis in England following Boris Johnson's decision to suspend Parliament to push his Brexit plan. We will also talk about coverage of the ongoing devastating fires in Brazil's Amazon rainforest. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can find information at yourcallradio.org. You can also see the trailer for Vision Portraits. It's going to open tomorrow at Landmark's Opera Plaza Cinema in San Francisco. And you can find other openings in your area at yourcallradio.org. Today we are joined by award-winning filmmaker Rodney Evans. And since you talked a little bit about Brother to Brother, Rodney, for people who want to see that, can they find it online?
Yeah, Brother to Brother is on iTunes, so you could buy it or rent it on iTunes. I think it's also for sale on Amazon and Google Play,
great.
I believe. Yeah, so it's digitally available. There are DVDs floating around that are probably too expensive.
I also wanted to ask you, since you talked about your disease, in the film, we actually follow you to Berlin, to the Center for Sight Restoration, and you say that you feel like you've run out of options for any kind of treatment in the States. And that really struck me.
Uh-huh.
I thought, wow, really? He had to go to Berlin to try to get treated?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to say what that means about the state of medical treatment for these eye diseases and conditions, but this treatment that I pursued was not available in the U.S. At that time. I actually do think that there are a couple of people doing it in the U.S. now, but I was fortunate enough to meet another filmmaker named Joseph Lovett, who eventually became an executive producer on the film, who was losing his vision due to glaucoma, and he had directed a film called Going Blind. And he had done this procedure in Berlin and had positive results based on his glaucoma, and it improved his ability to see. And he showed me his before and after charts and gave me the contact info for Dr. Anton Fedorov, who runs the Center for Sight Restoration in Berlin, and just encouraged me to email him and send him my retinal exams and just to see if I would be a good candidate for the procedure. Because usually you do have to have some retinal activity left. So, you know, there has to be enough vision there for them to work with. And, you know, it's basically sending low-level electricity to your brain to kind of jumpstart your retinal cells to get them working again. And so I definitely had positive results from that experience. And it expanded my peripheral vision, and it did improve or strengthen the signal from my optic nerve to my brain. And so, you know, that is one of several different treatments that's happening now. Another one is a drug called Luxturna, which basically is a gene replacement where they've basically isolated the gene mutation that causes the dominant strain of retinitis pigmentosa, and you can literally get a shot that replaces that gene mutation and become fully sighted. And so for the people that do have that dominant gene mutation, or the most common gene mutation, that that drug Luxturna is FDA approved and available. Mm-hmm. So there are huge leaps and bounds happening within this community, and a lot of that has been due to the fortitude and just the expertise of the foundation fighting blindness, and so many doctors around the world that have just been working for decades, you know, trying to find remedies to these conditions. But I do think that we're on the precipice of some major changes.
Mm. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Jean in Berkeley. Hi, Jean. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I want to say...
Oh, Jean, can you turn off your radio?
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah. I want to say thank you for this wonderful, informative program. What I want to point out is that BART is doing a great injustice to the low vision riders by not maintaining their bright yellow strips on the escalator steps. I saw an incident. I was going down an escalator, and I noticed that there was a crowd behind a young man that was standing ready to board the escalator going up. And he was standing there and standing there, and finally, he took the courage to step on something, and the look on his face was one of elation. So we've got to remind BART that they have to keep those yellow strips maintained. Right now, it's terrible. Whenever I take BART, I always look for the strips, and most of them are gone. And that's what I wanted to share with you, that there are many low vision people that use BART, but BART has to do their job and maintain those strips. Thank you for letting me to get on the show.
Well, Jean, thank you so much. And in fact, watching Rodney's documentary Vision Portraits made me think that we really need to do a show just about access. What is it like for people with a variety of disabilities, whether it's body pain, visual impairment, what have you, just to navigate?
Mm-hmm.
Your day-to-day.
Yeah.
In fact, Rodney, there's a scene in the film about what happened to you on your weekly commute on Amtrak. I mean, and I just was in New York, and I had some heavy luggage. I couldn't find an elevator. And
yeah.
I thought, what if you're in a wheelchair?
Right.
There's no elevator.
Yeah.
So talk about what happened when you were on Amtrak. You were dozing off, and we've all been there before, where you get up and all of a sudden the doors open and you try to get off very quickly.
Yeah, yeah. I got off and it said, I heard someone over the loudspeaker saying Penn Station, which is my stop where I'm supposed to get off. And so I quickly gather my belongings. I have my red and white cane out. I'm trying to get to the door. People are behind me. They're pushing me. They're yelling, move, move. We have to get out. Like, move it. What are you doing? Move it. And literally, like, I get to the door and stick my cane in the door to prevent it from closing, and the door opens, and I literally have to turn around and say, I am effing blind. Because they did not see the red and white cane. The expectation would be that I was moving faster. Why wasn't I moving faster? What was wrong with me? Mm-hmm. That I couldn't just flow easily up this path and with quickness and deftness and get out the train, because people had places to go, and why was I holding them up, you know? And so they were so apologetic after I said that. But, you know, for me, it was one of those things where it was like, oh, this is a real a world of assumptions that you're fully sighted and able-bodied. And when you're not, that becomes a shock to the system. And sometimes after the fact, people are very apologetic and sorry that they acted in the way that they did. But that does not prevent you from feeling the way that you felt, because they were literally shoving on your body for you to get out of the door. So
there's a couple things going on here. Just the things that we interact with on a regular basis. Can you talk about do you feel like things, when we're talking about trains and street signs and that kind of thing, has it gotten better or worse, do you think, over the years in terms of just navigating?
I think it could be a lot better. It's hard to say because my vision is deteriorated, right? So for me to make a comparison, it's hard to say because of my difference in capacity. I will say that, you know, when you visit countries in Europe, there's an automated voice that says walk, don't walk, you know, like things like that, that just, I live in New York, that doesn't exist. Or if it exists, it's super rare. How helpful would that be for a completely blind person trying to navigate the traffic or live an independent life or get to the subway station, to just have a voice that's, you know, that's green light, go, walk, red light, stop. You know, just very simple things like that that so many countries have that are incorporated into their systems. I think with accessibility, just elevators, restaurants being built with the width of the wheelchair in mind, ramps, all of those things. I have so many friends that, you know, are in wheelchairs that can't go places because they are afraid of checking their wheelchair on an airplane, frankly, because it's so expensive that if it was to get damaged, their whole life would be completely destroyed. The chair is part of their livelihood. A producer on this film just saw the film like 2 weeks ago after being, you know, out in the world at South by Southwest, at all of these different film festivals, you know. So the film has been traveling since March. It's August, right? He's just seeing the film because literally there is no way for him to be able to check his wheelchair without the guarantee that it won't be damaged on a flight, because that's just how we operate in the States, right? And so this is a very expensive wheelchair. It's pivotal to his work life, to his existence. And he's basically was very frank with me. He was like, Rodney, I can't take the chance that this chair is going to get damaged on my way to a festival. So I have to wait until it's at a place where it's driving distance. And, you know, so, I mean, that just stories like that are heartbreaking because it's obviously just a gap in the institutional knowledge and what people need in order to navigate.
I also wonder, given that I feel like things are so much more chaotic in terms of, you know, people honking at you if you don't move when they think you should. Like you said, the people behind you, move, move, move.
Right.
I just feel it more than I ever have.
Yes.
And when you're talking about someone in a wheelchair, we can see that.
Yeah.
But there are disabilities that we cannot see.
Sure.
Like what if you don't have your cane, for example?
Yeah.
So can you talk, how does that affect you? Just this move, move, meanness kind of.
I mean, it's awful. You know, it is a culture of people being incredibly self-involved. It's hostility and aggression on 11 a lot of the times. And I try not to get super political when I talk on these shows, but I do think that tone gets set from the top down, right? And so if you have someone in the Oval Office who's being hostile and aggressive and provocative and self-involved all the time in your face for 2 years, it's hard to say that that's not impacting the culture in some way, and that people are not absorbing that and taking that in as a way of being. You know, it's not about kindness or generosity or, hi, is there a way that I can help you? You seem to be having a little bit trouble crossing the street. Is there, what can I do to make your life a little easier? You know, can I slow down a bit and look around the world and maybe not be in my iPhone, but actually be present and looking and in the moment and seeing what's happening around me. So I think part of it's the technology that we're always in. It's the fear of missing out. It's the something's going on somewhere else that's so much more exciting that I need to be digitally connected to, so I'm not here in my body. And the people that are in front of me are just blockages, right? Mm-hmm. They're just in my way, and I got to get to this thing that's more exciting than where I am. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a mix of different things. But I do think it has gotten exponentially worse in terms of that lack of empathy and generosity. And so, you know, I hope that it changes and that things can turn around where people get a little bit more empathetic towards each other.
Yeah. How do you like people to approach you? What feels right?
A lot of times I like people just to ask, you know, just to say, is there a way that I can help you? Do you need help crossing the street? Are you okay? You know, that sometimes is the best way. And then if I do need help, I will say I do. Yeah, it would actually be helpful. Can you tell me where the elevator button is? You know what I mean? Or so, sometimes you're just in a congested place and, you know, and then sometimes if you stop and ask someone just to have them stop and take the time out of their day, if they see you with a red and white cane, to say, you know, to take their headphones out and to pay attention to you and to say, like, hey, you don't have the capacities that I have, so let me, like, stop for a minute and ask you where you're trying to go and see if I can help you. So that happens a lot, where I'll say, excuse me, and people will have their headphones on and we'll just keep it moving.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? I would say like 50% of the time that's what happens. And so asking, you know, sometimes it's like, do you want to take my elbow as we're navigating this space that is incredibly crowded and challenging and maybe dark. And so a lot of times, you know, close friends of mine will know that and they'll just say, you know, do you want to grab an elbow here's an elbow, you know, because they know that'll make me feel more comfortable in this space, because, you know, probably them as a fully sighted person is having a little bit of trouble navigating this incredibly crowded space of Penn Station, right? So they're imagining what it must be like for me. So,
right.
So that can be helped, just vocalizing. Can I help you?
We're almost out of time, but since you brought up Kayla Hamilton, I loved her. I love modern dance, and she's such a beautiful dancer.
Yeah.
So just quickly, when Kayla Hamilton was born, she had functional vision out of her right eye. Around 4 or 5 years old, the doctor said she needed to wear a patch. So she said when she put the patch on, she couldn't see anything, so all she did was sleep. And her parents wanted to keep her active and engaged, not worried about her eyesight, so they put her in dance classes. And she said, my best dancing is when my eyes are closed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think
how did you meet her?
I met Kayla, honestly, through a colleague where I teach at Swarthmore College in the dance department. Mm-hmm. And Kayla's the one person that I did not know at all. So Ryan Knighton, who's the writer in the film, I was friends with, and he had written a memoir called Cockeyed that dealt with his diagnosis of retinitis pigmentosa and growing up, and I was really moved by that memoir. And through mutual friends within the film industry, we got connected and became friends and have been friends for 10 years. John Dugdale, I knew, just my brother's best friend, dated him for over 10 years. So Kayla was the one I didn't know at all. And just to be really frank with you, I didn't want to make a film with all men. And so I went to a colleague of mine in the dance department and I said, I am looking for a female dancer who's visually impaired, preferably a woman of color. And he connected me with Kayla. We had brunch on a Sunday. It was just this fortuitous moment that she was coming to the end of this 3-year cycle of creating this solo dance performance called Nearly Sighted that was opening the next weekend. We immediately hit it off, like, amazingly. We completely trusted each other. It was just intuitive. I asked her if I could come and film rehearsals on Wednesday and Thursday, and if I could film her opening night performances on Friday and Saturday. She said yes. It was an all open pass. She had an incredible community of predominantly African-American women choreographers and stage managers at this place called Bad helping her. So that was just one of those things where everything aligned in this beautiful way really quickly in a short time period. And so she's been traveling with me a lot, doing a lot of the Q&As, and is a big supporter of the film.
I just loved her story. She said, having more limited vision than other artists gives me more access to sensation. The visual of how I look is less important than what I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. I thought that was just so beautiful.
Yeah, I think that's you know, where she gets her energy from as a dancer. It's how she is connecting with the rhythm and the emotion internally and what it's doing for her internally, and stepping out of that space of watching herself and just giving herself over to the rhythm and to the emotion. And that's where the power of her dance comes from.
Well, you can meet Kayla Hamilton in Rodney Evans' new documentary, Vision Portraits, along with two other artists, and learn more about Rodney's story. Rodney is an award-winning filmmaker. If you are in San Francisco, Vision Portraits opens tomorrow at Landmark's Opera Plaza Cinema in San Francisco. Rodney will be at 3 Q&As. Friday, tomorrow night at 7:10, and then on Saturday at 2:30 and at 7:10 p.m. And the 7:10 p.m. screening will be open audio description. And you can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org. Rodney, thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a delight.
And thanks for sharing your beautiful film with us.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Thank you. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We've got a lot to discuss: the G7 summit, Brexit, and the ongoing devastating fires in Brazil's Amazon rainforest. You can find out more about the show and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.